Hello, everybody, and welcome to the DieCast. My name is Roots Garn. With me are my co-hosts, Seamus.
Hello.
Josh.
But what is a co-host, really?
And Chris.
A miserable pile of secrets, Josh.
And we're going to mix it up a little bit this week. Instead of going straight to what has been occupying our miserable, cold little lives, we're going to go on to what's been occupying the miserable, cold little games industry.
I fear change.
Some good news for those of you who like to make videos that are free free advertising for major games companies. Nintendo's going to let you do that. And they've even got this awesome revenue sharing policy that they want to lay out for you on how you can get started making free ads for Nintendo. It's very simple. You guys ready for the rules?
Sure, I'm excited about Nintendo and videos. I like Nintendo games.
I'm just going to read straight from the Nintendo Creators Program guidelines here. You can register single videos or entire channels. When you register a channel, you'll be eligible to receive a share of advertising revenue from Nintendo for all videos included in that channel, regardless of their content. See? They're being really nice. They're letting you keep some of the profits you make from your videos.
It is so offensive.
The advertising revenue share is 70% for channels and 60% for videos. This rate may be changed arbitrarily. The 70% of revenue that you get from YouTube for your videos, wow!
And there's other rules, like, there's an important one. They have a list of approved games. You're allowed to talk about those. There's a list of games they don't approve, and you can't cover those games or they won't approve your channel.
Yes, you can only use channels or videos that contain copyrighted content related to game titles specifically specified by Nintendo, and they must be your original creations. Be sure your videos do not contain copyrighted material from third parties or content from unconfirmed game titles. So I guess, so they mentioned that you can specify certain videos and titles that are part of the program. So I guess this means is if you make let me look at their arbitrary list of Nintendo games that are supported here. It's a long list, right? Just read off the whole thing. It's a lot of what you'd expect, but I'm sure there's at least a few glaring omissions here somewhere.
Well, Smash Brothers being one of them, but the reason for that is obvious.
Fire Emblem is also not on there.
Yeah. So let's say I wanted to make a Game and Wario video and thanking my Nintendo overlords for the blessed ability to both do this and make the advertising revenue I am owed by YouTube for making this video. I couldn't also just include, a clip from a game by a studio that doesn't give a shit about people making them free advertising, or else I would not be eligible for profit.
It's like they want you to be, the way I read it, they're basically saying, if you agree to only cover our games exclusively, and the ones we approve of, and in the way we approve of it, and you give us the ability to veto your videos, we will only take 30% of your money.
Oh, Seamus, it's so much worse than that. There's an addendum here, an announcement. I'm sorry, I should have gotten this in with the other link I sent you for this, Rutskarn, but I thought it was there. So let me read this quote from this. Note, if you have not submitted your channel for registration yet, if a video within your channel contains game titles outside of the list of supported games, please remove it from the channel before registering. If you are unable to remove the video from your channel, please register each video that contains game titles on the list of supported games individually. So, if you want to cover, games that are not Nintendo games, you have to register each video for the program individually. If you want to just have your whole channel registered, you have to remove all of the content you've done in the past that doesn't have Nintendo games in it.
Which, so here's the thing.
Nobody is ever going to do.
Yeah. Yes, this is going to, this whole thing appeals to one group of people, which is wannabe YouTubers. People who are just starting out and think that, oh, well, maybe Nintendo games will be my niche. And even most of them will be scared away by the 60 to 70%. That's brutal, considering how low the profit margins already are on YouTube.
Yeah, like Total Biscuit's gonna go for this? No, he's just going to never talk about Nintendo games. I don't think he covers them anyway. But the point is that those big names are just, there's no way they would sign on for this.
Like, do they have the internet in Japan, Nintendo? Do you know what the internet is? Do you know how people use it? And I say this facetiously. Of course they do that in Japan. But holy shit! Can Nintendo never get the internet right?
No,
I mean, this
Nintendo
is not,
is...
like, the first isolated incident of Nintendo totally not getting the point when it comes to online stuff. I mean, you still can't, as far as I'm aware, de-link video game purchases from one particular console. Like, if you download a digital copy of a game on your Wii U, and then that Wii U dies, don't you have to buy another copy of that game?
You can do it, but you know how you do it? You have to actually call their support and basically have them, on their end, manually unassign the licenses from your old Wii U to your new Wii U. The entirety of Nintendo's internet infrastructure is abysmal. Like, it's why I'm not really interested in getting one of the new 3DSs when they come out, because I have a ton of digital games that I've purchased on the 3DS over the past couple of years, and to transfer that stuff over is probably going to be just as bad as transferring the Wii to Wii U, which required you to literally, like, load an SD card up with the game and physically transfer the games over in a certain mode. It was awful. I hated it, especially because I, at that point, had not used my Wii in a long time. It was sitting in a closet somewhere, so I had no way to get my old games out. So, yeah, Nintendo was very, very ardent about sticking around in the 1990s of digital rights and internet access. I don't know why, but they are.
Retro is in, you guys. Yeah, but no, I actually attended a conference on games marketing where they had, like, people who've worked on really big marketing campaigns up there. And, you know, they basically said the old models of advertising and, you know, distributing and marketing your game, they're not dead. You know, they said a lot of the sort of the, oh, well, you know, you absolutely can't bother with this kind of traditional advertising, is bullshit. You know, you still, journalists and reviews are still very important. But they said, you know, at this point, pretty much everybody has buckled down and admitted that a YouTuber can really push those numbers around. And that you really need to get those YouTubers in your corner. And it's hard to imagine with Nintendo just already kind of on the ropes at this point that they would think that this would help.
Well, it is kind of Nintendo, the way Nintendo works. I mean, they've always been really, really obtuse and blunt and slow to change. Like, they spent probably two entire console generations being completely behind the curve. You know, they had a good thing with the Nintendo Entertainment System, then they did the SNES, and it was also cool. But then they decided to, because they wanted to have full control of the game media, to stick with really, really inconvenient cart-based game media for the N64, and that really hurt the system, and they totally pissed off Sony enough to the point where Sony actually entered into the games market and took over Nintendo's spot. And then they spent, you know, they've never caught up from that. They've never been the premier gaming company since then, and they were just so stubborn about it. You know, this is not the first time this has happened to Nintendo, and they always sort of seem to be just so fucking stupid sometimes, you know? Just like, oh, we gotta protect our brand name. We'll do it by completely, by completely worthlessly and meaninglessly attempting to suppress everything else.
I don't know. I'm more bothered by the idea that Nintendo seems to believe they have absolute ownership over every frame that's ever produced and ever in any one of their games, which is really kind of troubling. Because it's pretty clear a lot of this stuff is aimed primarily at Let's Players, but their policy is not framed in a way that's, hey, you want to do a Let's Play of Mario? Great, sign up for our program and we'll let you do a Let's Play of Mario. No, their framing is very, very much, if you're using, you know, copyrighted footage from us, you need to go through this program of pre-approved games. So what, like,
would you
no
like
one's
to
ever allowed to talk
army
about Smash Brothers?
Yeah. Well, that's the other sort of problematic part of this, is that, like, is what Nintendo's doing even really legal? Like, nobody's
ever... Oh, it's legal.
Nobody's figured out, like, the legality of Let's Plays, right? Like, because Are they fair use or not?
Legal is a bit of an irrelevant question. If you play through a Nintendo game, you're going to hit that cutscene where Mario makes Mario noises for 2.5 minutes. That's going to hit the content ID system. And then it doesn't matter what the fair use law in your country of origin says. Nintendo is big and you are small and YouTube doesn't want to fight. Your video is going down, and that's all there is to it. So,
right.
Legality doesn't even enter into it. I mean, who cares if it's legal or
not? I mean,
good, bad, they're the one with the gun.
It should. And there's a lot of other, like, I mean, what if EA did this and said, like, oh, you can only have...
I've been waiting to bring that up.
You can only have revenue from Battlefield games in your... you can only get, like, 60% of that. We're taking the other 40. Like, what if they did that for all of their games catalog? You know,
what if others joined them?
Would people think that that was okay?
Another wrinkle here is that, of course, YouTubers are relying less and... I mean, once you hit it big, you stop relying so much on YouTube income, and you move to Patreon. Because, you know, Patreon doesn't get random takedown notices that hits your bottom line, and you're not a victim to that. And then you run no ads, and if you piss Nintendo off, what? They'll just run ads over your video. Who cares? I make my money through Patreon. So that's a change that's coming. That's happening. I mean, that's where we are. I think that's where the future is. That's a question of what YouTube's going to do in the future.
Yeah, when Patreon's we're all making awesome our... to me. I could... I lagged out and interrupted you a bit there, but I mean, I do all my stuff as like written novellas. There really is not a distribution service for this stuff that would be as effective as what I'm doing now. You know, even like if I was on Amazon or something, they take a pretty hefty cut.
Patreon's been very good to all of us, and what do we care? We don't run ads. Like, what does YouTube think of this? Screw Nintendo. What does YouTube think of the fact that we upload an hour of video every single week, we never run ads over it, and it's just we use them as free video hosting? Sooner or later, YouTube is going to run the numbers and realize that that's happening in a lot of places, and they're going to want to change it.
Has YouTube ever been profitable, though?
I don't imagine they want to be unprofitable forever.
Right, but
if
they definitely
wanted to start making money, now's the time. They've killed all the competition. I mean, there's nothing that can compete with. What is Viddler going to come back from the dead?
Well, I mean, Blip.tv is kind of still out there. VO, I guess.
I keep hoping Blip will turn it around. Really, Blip would be so much better if they just had a few more sponsors. It's not the ads that bug me. It's the unskippable same ad at the top of every 10-minute video. It's just this Chinese water torture of advertising. But I think we're drifting off. That's another thing. If you want to do Let's Plays of Nintendo games, you can always just jump to Blip.
Well, I don't know. Can you... I think you can do Nintendo games on YouTube that are, you know, as long as you're not doing the revenue share stuff, you know, as long as you're not putting ads on the video at all. I don't think Nintendo does anything. I mean, maybe they
do.
We've never tried it.
Don't
do Nintendo games.
No, the videos are good. Nintendo's entire policy is they have things that detect the content, and if it comes up as detecting the content, they place their ads in front of your videos, whether you originally
had
ads or not.
Right, but it's not like you can't use this video at all.
That's their policy. Like, that's their official stance. Is, like, if you go read the website, let me pull it up real quick. In the past, advertising proceeds that could be received for videos that included Nintendo copyrighted content, such as gameplay videos, went to Nintendo, according to YouTube rules. Now, with this service, Nintendo will send you a share of these advertising proceeds for any YouTube videos or channels containing Nintendo copyrighted content that you register. Their official policy is, hey, you made a thing with us? Fuck you, give me money. Like, that's their official policy, which is why this is so aggravating.
Right, all of it.
But
give us all
of it. But it's not like... hey, you don't want to put ads on this video, you can't use this video at all. You know, it's like, oh, we'll just put ads over this video. It's not like they're blocking all of them unless you do the whitelist stuff, which I think was like the fear at first, was that that was going to be how it was going to be.
It's a crappy policy regardless. It does not benefit anybody. It doesn't, it's not even tenable. Like, it's not even tenable as a Nintendo. If I was a Nintendo fan who wanted to make YouTube videos or gameplay footage videos, you know, I can't make a gameplay footage video of Smash Brothers because Nintendo can't monetize that because it features characters like Namco's Pac-Man. Therefore, Smash Brothers is off the list. You know, Nintendo is very concerned if a game has licensed music or if a game has any sort of third-party characters. That's why they have this very cut-down list of things that are 100% Nintendo owned, so that they can feel comfy knowing that if they're taking a slice of the IP, they're comfortable making money off of your content, but they're not comfortable taking money from other companies' content, which is part of the whole shadiness about all this.
Yeah.
I think we're probably about ready to move on to the next news item we have. This is kind of a out of nowhere one, I think, for everybody, including apparently the people who were the first to receive this news. So you guys might know of Sony Online Entertainment, a company responsible for managing such titles as DC Online and EverQuest 2 and the first EverQuest still, unaccountably. Yeah. And now they have a game which is
Star Wars Galaxies.
Yeah.
Motherfuckers. Okay, in fairness, my feelings on SOE are kind of mixed. Like, yeah, they fucked up Star Wars Galaxies, but they were probably the first game to fuck up in that way. So, I mean, I guess I can't fault them for following the pack. Because Star Wars Galaxies came out before, you know, World of Warcraft, and it was, you know, people kind of expect, like, I get the feeling there was a lot of, like, pushback from, like, LucasArts on this, which is, like, they were kind of expecting Star Wars Galaxies to do what World of Warcraft did. And maybe they were okay with it at first, but then World of Warcraft came out, smashed all the records, and, you know, Star Wars Galaxies was, like, maybe 200, 250,000 subscribers at its peak. You know, World of Warcraft comes out, and immediately it's got, like, 4 million subscribers, and it's insane, and then I think there was a lot of pushback that was like, oh, hey, what the fuck? This is Star Wars. Come on. You couldn't make a game that did that with Star Wars. And that's when everything kind of went off the deep end and, like, the whole game got revamped with a really shitty, like, World of Warcraft-style tacked-on system. Yes. And, ugh.
So, anyway, the news is that they became Daybreak Game Company. And to complete that incredibly generic, baffling company name.
Isn't that one of the Twilight books?
To complete that, I just want you guys to check out this press release. I'm going to read through it, like, real quick.
It was posted on their forums, by the way. Not like on their website or something. The first one was posted on their forums.
If you Google Sony Online Entertainment, it'll still bring you to, like, their main page as Sony Online Entertainment. That's how sudden this change is. They didn't even have a new layout ready to roll out. But anyway, I want you to read this, and for those of you who've listened to the diecast before where we've come against press releases, I want you to count off all of the familiar, baffling things about it. Anyway. Dear players, partners, and friends. Now, as I keep reading this, I want you to see if you could spot which of those three people this press release is really directed to. So, first line. Today, we are pleased to announce that we've been acquired by Columbus Nova, an investment management firm well known for its success with its existing portfolio of technology, media, and entertainment-focused companies. So, yeah, obviously, like, Goku69 really gives a shit about all of the successes of Columbus Nova investment management firm. Anyway, moving on. This means that effective immediately, SOE will exist, operate as an independent game development studio where we'll continue to focus blah blah blah. Yes, that means PlayStation and Xbox, mobile, and more. As part of this transition, SOE will now become Daybreak
and more?
Game Company.
I love and more.
Yeah. What else is
That's
and
my favorite
more?
Platform.
Because they don't make games for Wii U, so what else is there?
Nobody makes games LARP? For the Wii U.
Should I look out for the Daybreak Game Company live-action roleplay system? Because I probably would not play that, actually. As part of this transition, SOE will now become Daybreak Game Company. This name embodies who we are as an organization and is a nod to the passion and dedication of our employees and players. It is also representative of our vision to approach each new day as an opportunity to move gaming forward. To move gaming forward. So what exactly does this mean for you? It will be business as usual, and all SOE games will continue on their current path of development and operation. In fact, we expect to have even more resources available to us as a result of this acquisition. It also means new exciting developments for our existing IP and games, as we can now fully improve... I just can't read any more of this bullshit.
So, what I take it is...
Is there a reason they couldn't go back to Verint games? That was what the initial developer was... That was the initial developer of EverQuest, and a lot of the people from that came over to Sony Online Entertainment when they merged...
I don't think that name was quite generic enough to represent the interests of Columbus Nova investment management firm.
So my takeaway here is Columbus Nova was sitting around their smoky boardroom and saying, video games, my grandkids are playing these video game things. Do we own any of that? It sounds like it's going to be big someday. We should buy some of that in case it takes off. And then this happened.
No, Seamus, haven't you been paying attention? A bunch of old men were sitting around a smoky boardroom. One of them takes a long drag off a reedy cigar and says, you know, boys, I could really go for some driving the industry of gaming forward each and every day with exciting new investments. But business as usual, of course. Oh, of course, yes, of course. So yes, this press release is basically saying that everything is awesome, but nothing is changing, but things are going to get better, and the end.
Please don't sell the stock. Please, oh God, whatever you do, don't sell any stock.
I'd like to read you some of the informed responses on the first page of the forum, but I can't because there aren't any.
Because it's a locked thread.
Yeah, well, also, it just oscillates very widely between... Oh, awesome! I can't wait for more awesome stuff from you guys, to everything is already fucking terrible, and this is gonna make things worse, you con artists. Give me my money back.
So I tried to open the Columbus Nova website, and I couldn't, because apparently it doesn't like Flash Player. It also looks like the... I was able to get the About Us page open, and it looks like something that was
Our
made in 2004.
Our first task will be to hire somebody to make a website for us.
According to... Wikipedia, they own Fiverr, which I don't know what that is, but they also own Rhapsody, which is that music store.
Wow, that's much more information than is on their fucking website.
Yeah.
Their website is apparently copyright 2006.
And one of their partners owns Harmonix, I guess?
Oh, okay. That's significant.
When was the last time they made a video game?
They made Fantasia, and they're making Amplitude. Anyway... I'm curious to see why Sony felt like... This feels to me like Sony needed liquidity more than anything, and this was a pretty nice, easy chunk to throw up on the chopping block for acquisition. Because it's not a huge moneymaker, as far as I know, for them, and yet they have enough IPs and, you know, EverQuest and everything else, and the amount is undisclosed, so we obviously don't know whether this was a great deal for Sony or not, but... They have not been doing great as a company lately, and additional liquidity is probably something they're looking for.
I was like, their games division is doing all right, but isn't like the rest of the company just kind of in really dire straits at this point?
Yeah, they have not been doing well for a couple of years.
Electronics divisions.
Yeah, and that's why I'm wondering if this is a play for liquidity for some sort of investment they needed to pay off, or just to make their stock, you know, stay afloat. And make managers look good, or if this is something else. Like, basically, I'm trying to figure out, was this a play for liquidity or stock, you know, keep the stock up, or was this a play to, like, actually shed Sony Online Entertainment because they didn't see themselves in the MMO space? And given that they have a game console, I don't think it's that. I think it's the former.
Yeah, well, SOE hasn't been terribly relevant in the MMO space for a long time. But then again, not very many companies have been terribly relevant in the MMO space for a long time, because there isn't really one anymore. What new MMOs are coming out? Name a new MMO that's coming out that's not a DayZ clone or a MOBA. if that even counts.
Is it already out?
Fuck, I don't know. Yeah, it's not already out. Well, who's making new ones nowadays? You know, it's almost like the genre is dead at this point.
Almost like.
Well, I mean, you can't say the genre is dead because World of Warcraft still has like 10 million subscribers.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, okay, so it's not dead, but it's like new games have been impossible for so long.
Oh, for like the past decade. The only successful new games that I can think of are like Guild Wars 2.
And you'd have to figure that if free-to-play was really a desirable endpoint for a lot of these games that have come out and then gone free-to-play, that they would have initially been free-to-play. Like, obviously there's probably just so much, like, complicated, well, you know, we wanted to do this, this was a good way to make some initial investment back, so then we switched to this strategy. But I can't help but feel like a lot of companies ended up disappointed in their investment and ended up just cutting their losses.
There was an interesting point. I read an article on Gamasutra by an industry analyst talking about The Elder Scrolls Online when it was announced that that game went free-to-play like 2 or 3 weeks ago. And his point was, like, everybody has been talking about this. Like, ZeniMax was just, like, being completely ignorant of the way the market was. No way, you know, realistically, there's no way that The Elder Scrolls Online would have ever stayed subscription MMO. Even if it was a good MMO, it wouldn't have stayed a subscription model for very long in this market. And this guy's point was, maybe they knew that, and they were trying to milk as much money out of the subscription model while they could with all the people who were willing to pay subscription. Not enough to sustain the game long term, but for the short term, they could get that big payoff of money for like the 11 months that the game has been a subscription game. And then they would switch over to free to play and sustain the game on microtransactions.
You know, the thing is, that's far from a slam dunk. You know, there's the problem is that a lot of the current players are very much invested in the idea that it is subscription-based and the curated space. You know, you see a lot of discussions on their websites, like, if this game went free-to-play, I would immediately just stop playing it. And I feel like it's actually kind of important to the initial push of the MMO to get people invested in that sort of early game. You know, like, I don't know how many people really care too much about The Elder Scrolls Online at this point, and are like, oh, it's free to play, I might as well hop on board and buy the copy and then free to play it when everybody's already way ahead of me.
It is worth noting that, yeah, you still have to buy the box for The Elder Scrolls Online. You can't just download the client and play the game.
Yeah, so I think maybe if they put out a huge advertising push, they could recoup, you know, the same free-to-play audience they would have had on day one. But, yeah, I don't know. You know, on the paper, I feel like it could make sense or it could be a bad idea. And I think, really, we'll just have to see. Or, you know, maybe not see, because game companies aren't often transparent about their numbers here. Anyway, you guys want to move on to the next item?
Before we do, I just want to point out, while I'm Wikipediaing all these companies, this is probably old hat to a lot of you guys, but did you guys know that in October 2014 there was an EverQuest expansion released? The first EverQuest?
Yeah.
They've still
been keeping that game up. Like, aren't they doing something with that game where they're like reviving like old code for the servers and like, hey, this is like 2001 mode EverQuest and you can go and like play with all these really, really shitty time-wasting mechanics? I think that's cool. I mean, EverQuest is like still got a bunch of people playing it, which is not. I mean, you hear about all these MMOs that are dying after a couple years. It's kind of nice that a few old timers are still running. Because that's always been the other problem with MMOs. It's like, not only are they super expensive to make and everybody's playing World of Warcraft, but like they're temporary inherently. They don't have like the sort of virtue of like, you know, I can go and play X-Wing or, you know, Monkey Island now. I could go and get like go find the floppy disk copy or the CD copy or whatever or get a disk image and mount it on a virtual drive and just play the game. You can't do that with an MMO. Once the MMO is dead once the servers get shut down. That's it. And, like, you can, like, maybe hope that somebody will revive that with, like, private server emulation, which is kind of in a legally gray area at the moment. But, like, for the most part, you know, I can't go back and play Star Wars Galaxies now if I wanted to, because it's dead.
I wonder how much it costs to make an expansion for EverQuest compared to other games. I mean, I know they've revamped the Arnat.
$7.
Well, it's more than that, but I'm just curious.
Well, yeah, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot they increased minimum wage. All right, it's like $7.50.
You're saying it takes a person 1 hour to make...
Yes, somebody who doesn't know what they're doing. I snark, it's not actually that easy. It still takes time to make content, even if it's shitty content nobody cares about. It still takes time to make.
Anyway, so we have one more news announcement. There's been a bit of a kerfluffle about the game Evolve, which I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's, yeah, I don't know a whole lot about it either, to be honest.
It's a... Left
it's a DLC
for Dead
vehicle
slash the hidden stuff. Yeah, it's a DLC vehicle. It's sort of a it's a multiplayer game. It's a multiplayer PvP game where, like, one team is your, like, four-man human survivor team kind of thing, and the other team is just one player playing a super overpowered monster. And the goal
like
is to, like, fight the monster and kill it. Like, it's like if the entirety of Left 4 Dead was fighting a tank that could do more than just throw rocks at you. And it's really interesting in concept, because that kind of sounds cool to play, right? Like
kind of.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. But it's, like, they announced the game, and then, like, the first thing they announced after the game was announced was the DLC that you could buy when the game came out.
Yes. Specifically, the Turtle Rock Studios co-founder Chris Ashton said that the game was built from the ground up for add-on content. And he's like, Evolve will support more DLC than any other game before, or will support DLC more than any other game that came before. And the internet responded fairly predictably to this claim.
Yeah, this was the game where that guy was interviewed about it, and he said, "I don't like people thinking we're doing underhanded dirty shit." And the internet pretty much unanimously said, "Then maybe you shouldn't fucking do that."
Yeah, oh, I want to contrast, actually, that statement. So that statement came from the creative director, what's his name here? Phil Robb, and, you know, he's basically, like, talking to a journalist, and he's like, "I don't understand it. I thought it'd be really cool if we had all this stuff and just, like, new maps and stuff, if you don't get bored." And, you know, it's like, I can come away from that thinking, you know, I still think this is kind of shady, but, like, you know, whatever. And maybe this has a point. With just the weasel nonsense, the dribble out of Take-Two's mouth. Because, like, I guess Take-Two is publishing this game. Seal of quality. Take-Two CEO Strauss Zelnick basically said, "Yeah, people seem to hate the game. That's awesome. That's great. Really great. It's always a good sign people hate the game, but seriously, we really strongly believe in our product." I'm barely exaggerating here. Let me actually just read directly his quote. "There was some controversy, and I guess controversy, generally speaking, is a good thing. People can argue about the business model. I think we're developing a fantastic title that's well-versed with consumers who will pay for it." That's a really great answer to anything. "Hey, like, so what do you think about people's criticism of your tactics? I think we're making good games, and then people will enjoy paying money for them." Next question.
So, like...
There's just zero content in there. I mean, there's one more point that I really want to read off here, which is, he went on to say that Evolve, I'm quoting here from VG2487, which is, "Evolve was the only game in history to win Game of Show honors at both E3 and Gamescom in the same year."
Yay!
This
you
is
made
such
a press conference.
You made a good demo and independently got two people to say it was looking really good. Only person in history. You know, I actually have a really important announcement for you guys. The game Unrest is the only game to get a, "Wow, that looks pretty good," in pre-production from both my mother and my father. And also some guy I showed it to. He was like, "Wow, that
True
sounds really
facts.
Interesting as you're describing it to him." And I'm like, yeah, wait till you play it in 8 months.
The problem with Evolve is like, yeah, sure, free-to-play game, you know, you buy maps and monsters and whatever, that's cool. It's not free-to-play, it costs $60! And then you buy, like, $15 single monster packs on top of that, which have been announced and detailed on their website. It's crazy. Like, the collector's edition to get, like, all this stuff is, like, $100. Come on!
Some of them are objectively better than the other, so it's not just a shitload of DLC for sale on day one at launch, but it's pay-to-win DLC. And they haven't even built... They didn't even have the decency to build up some buzz before they started in on this, which shows that their heart is kind of in the wrong place, too. And, yeah, it feels really skinny.
It's sort of like the worst kind of DLC where... We can debate, like, on-disc DLC, whether that's good or bad, but on-disc DLC is one thing, and it's another to just sort of have a game that feels like it's fundamentally missing stuff that retails for $60. And the game ships with, I think, one or two Titans. Is it two?
I think it's only one. It might be two. I don't know. Don't quote me on this. I haven't been paying too much attention to Evolve since all of this happened. You know what? No, I think it is two. But yeah, but there's like three or four more that you can buy individually or in like two packs or something.
And it's
so
it's not
over
cosmetic,
half of
and
them.
It's just
so over. It's not like there's
yeah.
four and one
yeah,
one more
much
for sale.
More
it's
than
over
half
of them. Wow. This is okay. For context, this is what everybody was afraid of when the DLC craze started like 3 or 4 years ago. Everybody will be like, they'll give us a half-finished game, and you know, then they'll try and sell us the other half, and games will end up costing $100. And it took 4 years, but here we are.
So can you buy horse armor for your Titan?
I think the baffling thing about this is not that they're trying to get away with this, because of course they are. You know, how could you not figure out if people are stupid enough to pay for this shit? Well, you owe it to yourself, as a capitalist entity, to figure out if people will actually shell out $15 for this kind of exploitative DLC practice. But the thing that shocks me is that they didn't have a plan for the feedback. Like, that they didn't have a plan for, like, managing this from a PR perspective.
Well, they didn't have a sense that this would cause any backlash, that they were really just completely surprised that they didn't, you know, dribble this out over weeks to slowly build any, they just
I'm
dropped
sure
it all.
I'm sure there was someone there that said, hey, maybe people are going to get pissed off about this. It's just that someone was clearly not their director of marketing.
I'm reading through all of the different versions you can buy, and there are way too many, and it's really, really confusing. But it does sound like there are four monsters total, one of which is just launching after launch that is $15. The other three are in the game, I think.
But in different versions of the game, like if you buy it here, you get these monsters, and if you buy it here, you get these monsters, or what?
It really is just a case study in really shitty MMO, like in the worst kind of DLC, not MMO, I don't know what I was talking about. The worst kind of, like, DLC galvanization of a title, you know, of the, like, oh, disc one DLC, or day one DLC. God, I should drink more. Day one DLC and, you know, Project $10 and all of that kind of stuff.
It's not the DLC. The more I'm reading about this, it's not the DLC amount that's bothering me. It's the convoluted breakdown. Like, they're giving you the first monster DLC if you pre-order, but if you don't pre-order, you have to pay $15 for the last behemoth. So already there's like $15 for the last monster, effectively. But beyond that, then they're also sort of like, the pre-purchase also comes with other exclusives depending on the retailer you pre-order at. For example, an instant hunter unlock. Or an exterminator weapon skin and other things like that. That's per retailer, and you have to figure out what retailer you want to go to get that stuff. But then there's the digital version, the digital deluxe version, which comes with the full game and the monster expansion and a bunch of the content that you don't get at the retailers. And then there's a hunting season pass info that's the season pass for the DLC that you get the first pack for free on. And I'm just like, this is a really complicated list of how you get all this stuff for what should just be a simple purchase.
Yeah.
Also, I'm kind of annoyed that they call the Ultra PC version the Evolve PC Monster Race Edition.
Monster Race.
Yeah. The unannounced fifth monster still in development. So there is going to be ultimately five monsters. And you get the fourth monster.
I'm not sure I'd say ultimately there. If they sell well enough, I'm sure there will be more.
I guess, but I'm getting a big Titanfall vibe from this, which is to say it's probably going to be an awesome little multiplayer shooter that people are going to play for a month and then drop like a rock. And I like Titanfall, but that game came and then went very, very, very quickly.
That game didn't really suffer from the same sort of DLC stuff, though.
No, it didn't suffer from the DLC stuff, but I'm wondering how long are people going to be invested in buying additional monsters for Evolve? I mean, what Evolve is effectively the tank fights from Left 4 Dead blown up to super huge proportions and without much of the trash mobs.
In a practical sense, this seems like a really stupid idea just to announce this much crap. I mean, for one thing, it's confusing, and confusion is never good for consumers. Consumers like it simple. Consumers are like, all right, I like the sound of this video game. I'm going to get out my credit card, and, oh, wait, which version do I, wait, okay, is there a wiki, you know what, I'll do this later, and then they go and they just never come back, because it's too hard to make the decision. So confusing, death of a decision. If you're talking a Left 4 Dead game, how that game worked is everybody learns the core game, and then you start adding maps and other stuff onto it. You add layers of complexity once everybody has the base game. Same thing with Team Fortress 2. If you come out with too much stuff at the beginning, it feels like everybody's playing three different games, and you don't get that critical mass of players who all discover and learn these set of mechanics. You don't have the, oh boy, new monster coming out, and it revitalizes the game. And instead, it's like, oh, they have this monster. I haven't fought this monster. Is this one overpowered? I don't know. I don't like fighting this. I can't be this monster. It fragments the entire community. It's bad and dumb. It was designed by marketing first and not really given consideration of what it's like to play a Left 4 Dead kind of game and how people shop for games. So, yeah, it strikes me as it's probably not going to go over that well.
I mean, I played the beta. It plays really. It's fun. I don't know if about its longevity, but it's fun if you like the tank fights in Left 4 Dead. But I just don't see how... I don't want to buy... Like, DLC should, as a general rule, always be supplementary. I like this core experience. Let me go and expand it. But when you start with a multiplayer game and start adding DLC to that, that really does do basically what Seamus was saying. It starts bifurcating the entire community, even if it's something as simple as a monster. I mean, like, I'm sure you won't have to buy the DLC to fight a monster that somebody else has. I hope not, because that's just as bad as Call of Duty's maps, where suddenly now you're kicked out of the thing, because, yeah. But even then, it's like...
Because not as many people have it, and I can't be this monster. I can only see this monster, and that makes me less interested in it. And there'll be people that only want to fight this particular monster. There's never a chance for anybody to get sick of the core mechanics before you introduce this new thing. So it's a menu with too many items, and everybody's going to be too spread out.
So, let's move on from depressing news to our depressing lives. Seamus, what have you been up to?
Okay, the big thing this week, I backed my very first Kickstarter, a game called Strafe, and I was super excited. Chris mentioned it last week on the Diecast. I looked it up. I was super pumped. It's procedural, retro night. It looks like a game from 1996, but it's procedurally generated. Looks awesome. Looks like the Kickstarter's gonna fail, and I'm sad. So I created a Kickstarter.
Really? I heard with all the coverage I heard about it, I figured they were gonna blow through the Kickstarter goal in a few days.
No, odds are looking worse every day. They're not even halfway to their goal, and they've got like.
Goal?
186,000, and they're over halfway. They're just over 100,000 though, and they need you know, like 190,000. So they're barely halfway there, and I think they have a little over a week left. Yeah, so it's looking pretty...
74,028 pledged of 185,096, which is like, why are we going into specific dollar amounts? What's up with that?
I know. So that looks really iffy without a huge marketing push.
It's 1996. It's a game from 1996. That's the joke, is it's a game in 2015 that's supposed to be the best game of 1996, which is why the total they're asking for is ending in $96. It's just a joke.
Oh, I see.
It looks like it's not going to make
it. If they failed, like, at $185,075 or something.
So, that's sad. But the good news is I played two great games this week. I played Life is Strange. I've just barely dabbled in Episode 1. I was apprehensive going in because this is by the team that made Remember Me, and that was kind of flat for me, and I did not like it. This is hitting all the marks. I am really digging it. It's got a good gameplay mechanic. You know, it's rewind time. So it's Prince of Persia, except instead of platforming, it's conversations and decisions about how you do things. There's even puzzles where you have to rewind time because there isn't enough time to do them without rewinding time. Really interesting. Love the art style. Just really, really great. Love it so far. I don't know if it'll pan out because obviously this is episode one of however many. The other game I played is Grow Home. It's really cool. It's another one of these weird arty Ubisoft titles that's got gorgeous retro graphics, and in this case it's really flat shaded polygons. Really cool. You're a robot trying to grow a plant that's hundreds of meters tall. It's weird. The gameplay isn't super awesome, but it's worth a trip through the game for the art. And that's what I did.
What the hell is going on with Ubisoft? Like, all of their AAA releases pretty much universally were bad last year, except, like, I guess Far Cry 4. But they also had Child of Light and Valiant Hearts and Grow Home, and is this a secret plot by Ubisoft to destroy the AAA games market by flooding it with crap so that indie games can take over? Like, what's going on?
There is no publisher right now I hate more in the AAA space than Ubisoft, and there is no publisher doing more good, interesting things with small games in the big space than Ubisoft. And I don't understand that dichotomy.
Like, they're Two-Face or something. It's weird.
Every day they wake up, flip a coin, and decide, okay, are we going to take another dump in the AAA shelf, or are we going to put another gem in the bargain bin for $8? Like, their indie stuff isn't even that expensive. Grow Home was like $8 or something. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, and Child of Light was like $20 when it came out, and I think Valiant Heart was 15. You know, it's weird that they have this sort of dichotomy where all of their big games are being made by, like, thousands of people and are just completely shit, and then they're just funding these small teams of, like, 10 or 15 people that are making really interesting indie-style games.
I wonder if somebody's running the numbers and looking at how much money you make compared to how much money you put into it and drawing new conclusions. Like, I've often wondered about this. Like, okay, if you have a really successful indie title, you know, what's the return on the investment compared to the return on investment compared to a really expensive AAA title? You know, because AAA title has to make a lot of money just to break even, where an indie title, you know, doesn't need to make that much to break even and start making money, even though it's less total money. That would be really interesting. No other company, like, has these numbers to compare. It's like, this company over here is doing indie, and this company over here is doing huge AAA, and they're not sharing their numbers. But Ubisoft alone is seeing both sides of this, and I have to wonder what's going on. I would love to know what they're thinking.
It's interesting. They're in a really good position to kind of step into the space in the market that has been empty for a long time, which is this sort of like middle ground games that are not AAA games but have bigger budgets and teams than typical indie games.
The $5 million budget You know, too big for an indie,
yeah,
but too small for a AAA game. And there's so much interesting stuff that can be done there at $5 million. And I would love to see more. And to be fair, I don't think any of these games we're talking about qualify.
No, yeah, I doubt the budget for, like, Child of Light was $5 million.
Yeah, so, I don't know, it's weird. Like Chris says, it's really weird.
Well, I played through Life is Strange last week, and I wanted to talk about it on the
Diecast.
No
spoilers.
And Seamus was like, no, I'm going to play it. And then I was absolutely sure that this was going to turn into another Walking Dead Season 2 situation where Seamus was super interested in playing it, but only when it came out, and was super interested in playing it until it was all out. But no, you actually played through the game, so that's cool. I think it's really interesting. It's a super Telltale Games game. Like, if you had told me that
it
Telltale
really is.
Made Life is Strange, I would not have questioned it. Well, I would have said, what happened to the facial animations? But aside from that, I wouldn't really have questioned that.
Yep, the models look a little better. The art style is a little more detailed. But yeah, the facial animation is really, everybody's face is really wooden, have a very narrow range of expressions. It strikes me as being like, that main character, if she gave a big smile, I think it would be creepy city. I think they just, their models are not up to the job of being expressive.
I think it's really cool. It's sort of, for people who haven't played the game, it's sort of The Walking Dead meets Twin Peaks via Gone Home. It's a Telltale style adventure game, but it's set in, you know, the Pacific Northwest. And weird shit starts happening in small town America, and suddenly the main character discovers that she has the ability to rewind time and mess with the timeline, and it actually kind of reminds me in construction of like a visual novel. Like, actually, it very specifically reminds me of one particular visual novel, which is Steins Gate, which I actually haven't played as a visual novel, but they did an anime, and it's very much sort of the same sort of story style, where a guy accidentally invents a time machine and discovers, you know, and kind of learns the sort of, maybe you shouldn't be messing around with time travel. And Life is Strange is very much similar to that. I really like it in that... Should I wait until Seamus comes back? I think I should wait until Seamus comes back, because he's the only one who's played it and can back me up.
I've played through the first 20 minutes of it, so I've played through, like, till the principal talks to you. So my opinion of it mostly is just I'm really, really enjoying it, but I don't know where they're going to take the mechanics. The time travel mechanics are weird. In Prince of Persia, you're rewinding time, and as a result of rewinding time, you basically get to redo attempts at platforming. Here, it's more of a puzzle-solving mechanic, and it's kind of awkwardly scripted-y.
It is a little, like, the time mechanics kind of feel really rough. Because it is a lot of like, oh, I go through this dialogue sequence, and the wrong answers are available to me, and then you know, the dialogue sequence plays out, and the character is embarrassed, and then she's like, okay, maybe I can rewind and remember this fact, and then you rewind, and then you have the option to pick the right answer now.
Yeah, it's weirdly, jiltedly scripted in a sense that, like, I'll put it this way. In back to the Prince of Persia comparison, you're rewinding time as it actually happened, so you might have a cap of, like, 30 seconds of time juice that you can rewind and then try to do your platforming over again. Here, your powers aren't really limited to an amount of time, but specific events. You can only rewind to the last, like, game mechanic relevant event that they want you to start this little challenge or puzzle or level from.
Yeah.
So like the conversation example, you can rewind to the beginning of the conversation, but you can't rewind to, you know, the beginning of the game. You can only rewind to the game, to the point where the game wants you to rewind to, which works, I guess, as sort of a hint system, sort of, by saying, figure it out within this space of time, but it's not like you're actually really rewinding time.
I also think it's kind of interesting from a game design perspective, where there's been this, for the past like 5 or 10 years, there's been this really big pushback from people who write dialogue in RPGs, which is like, you should not be able to save scum your way through conversation. You should not be able, like, there, a lot of people seem to hold this opinion that you should not be able to save right before a major decision point and then play around with, like, the different options that
yeah,
you can, like,
and this game
to see how
it
evolves. Which is something that annoys me, because I kind of like to do that. Like, I don't want to play through Mass Effect 6 different times to figure out what all the different story branches will lead to. I kind of want to just mess around with, like, to see, oh, what happens if I pick the Renegade Interrupt here? Okay, that's cool. Maybe I don't actually want to do that, though. You know, and like, the example that jumps out in my mind the most prominently is Alpha Protocol, where it would save with their stupid quick save system immediately after every major dialogue event, so you can't just go back and fix it if you screw up, which did not work fundamentally with their timed dialogue system, in my opinion. This game kind of revels in that idea of, like very specifically, yeah, the character will say, like, man, maybe I shouldn't have done that. I guess maybe I should rewind time to fix this situation and try the other option. Although it does get kind of weird when she says that, regardless of what you do. like the game, like the character is kind of like pushing you along in a tutorial prompt, maybe a little bit too much. But I kind of like that the game kind of just like, yeah, you have time travel power, so naturally you would be able to go back and fix things. You would be able to, you know, accidentally knock some files down in a way that would make it clear that you've been rummaging through this guy's stuff, and then think, okay, maybe I shouldn't, you know, tip him off that I've been rummaging through his stuff. So you rewind time. It's kind of cool in that way.
It's sort of the opposite of The Walking Dead in that sense, because instead of, like, you're using your time travel abilities not to explore a physical space, but sort of like a possibility space of people's interactions. So, like, you can call somebody a douche or whatever, and then they get upset, but then you can rewind time and be like, no, cool, you're cool, you're cool, you're nice, I'm going to be nice to you. And it's great because it lets you sort of explore people's reactions and sort of see how they really feel about you, and then sort of undo that. Like, it's sort of the antithesis of the Telltale, you know, Clementine will remember that. Here, nobody necessarily will remember anything because you can rewind time and just tell them something else. So it lets you sort of probe their personalities in a cool way, and I like that a lot.
Although it does still do those, like, messages, like, oh, this action will have consequences, and then you can rewind and undo the consequences. Something else I like about it is all the Telltale games have this sort of, like, this sense of, like, imminent peril in the background, which is completely absent in this game because it's set in a high school in Oregon. Like, there are situations where, like, there is some peril in the game, where a guy has a gun, which is, you know, that's not much of a spoiler, that's in the trailer. But, like, there's no, like, oh, I'm having this conversation with Clementine and some zombies are going to jump out of the woods at some point. There's none of that. Like, so the game is much more sort of sedately paced than a lot of Telltale games. And
yeah,
I like that it's kind of exploring the viability of the Telltale model to tell, like, stories that are that just have no combat. You know, there's no quick time event kind of combat in this game at all. And there are no quick time events in the game whatsoever. I think that's kind of cool.
That no, I agree.
It's telling
definitely.
this sort of like this narrative that you don't really see in video games because there is no, like, significant violence in it. Which video games are really bad at telling stories like that because, like, well, where are you going to get your mechanic style sort of conflict going? It's sort of like the text adventure writer's dream kind of game where you can just have a game that is like, it's about high school in Oregon where some weird, like, you know, typical sort of young adult novel stuff happens, which is completely unviable in most video games up until this point, just because, you know, where how do you sell people on playing a game where that's the only stuff that happens?
I love the opening of the game too, because I mean, okay, the cold opening of the game is sort of an action-y dream sequence, but the actual opening bit of the game is a lecture that you were bored in, and I love that the game has the guts to just sort of open with like, yeah, you're bored in class, and you can't skip it. You have to listen to the lecture and just sort of sit there while this goes on. And because it's a game about time travel, you actually end up doing that two or three times. And I love that. I love that the game has the guts to open by, like, making you listen to this guy three times.
Yeah. Rutskarn, so I wanted to actually mention this to you. So stop me if you've heard this before. So the game opens, and you find yourself in the woods at, like, night. And there's a lighthouse in the background. And as you approach the lighthouse, a great big vortex shows up. And then you wake up somewhere else. It is sort of just the opening of Alan Wake.
What's weird about it is the first thing I thought to myself when I saw the game is I was like, wow, this feels very much like the opening of The Longest Journey. And then my wife was sitting across the room, and she was like, that sounds like The Longest Journey. And she came over here and watched it. So, and I don't know, there was something, it's a dream sequence where there's a big storm in the background, and then you wake up and you're a student, and you're even kind of instead of a painter, you're a photographer this time. It had a strong Longest Journey vibe for me.
But, you know, again, the big downside of the game that I've seen so far is the facial animations are total shit. They are really bad, and the dialogue lip-syncing is abysmal. Like, I'm convinced there's some sort of bug there, because they could not have thought that was good enough to ship with.
I'm convinced that the main character has this really mopey attitude, and I wonder how much of that is deliberate, like, that they wanted to make a really mopey character. Like, she's really emo, and I wonder how much of that is like, wow, we can't animate anything else. Let's just make her emo.
I mean, it's got, like, the sort of 2004 BioWare game, like, oh, we're in a conversation, here's some generic conversation animations. Oh, I'm scratching my neck really awkwardly. It's weird. In a game that relies, like, so much more even than most Telltale games on, like, cutscenes, it's weird that they didn't put more into the facial animations, and it's kind of disappointing.
I really do have to say that I still need to play more of it to really get a strong feel for it, but it does have that weird translation thing going on, because it was made by a French development studio.
Right.
And it does have a little bit of, occasionally the dialogue is a little awkward, and also, like, it's high school, but she's in a, like, serious photography class. It's like an AP college-level photography class that would never, ever, ever be taught in high school in this country. And it's a little weird. Like, is she really kind of supposed to be in college or not?
Yeah, she's in, like, some sort of weird prep school or something is the background of this. Like, this is not a normal,
her school,
like, municipal high school or something.
Yeah, her school looks like a college campus. Inside it looks like an American high school, and then you get outside, which is the part of the school that they don't usually show on American television, and it looks very much like a campus. And I was scratching my head wondering if this was an age difference. Like, wow, if school's changed this much, and this is what they look like these days? But, yeah, I had the same vibe as Chris. Like, wow, this is some photography. I mean, I had a photography course in school, but it was just like, It was not this, you're going to be a professional photographer. It's, oh, here's how photo developing works, and here's how a camera works, and take a few pictures. It was not a, you're going to be a photographer for a living kind of class.
I mean, I wasn't bothered by the dialogue that much, but I've definitely heard that as, like, one of the chief complaints. It's like, this dialogue kind of sounds cliched. I didn't actually go to a physical high school, so I guess I don't really know what cliched high school dialogue would sound like, but...
Well, like, you know,
and it's been, like, years and years, so...
she says stuff like hella a lot, like that's hella cool, and it just, it's a little awkwardly.
Yeah.
It's not enough to ruin the game, but it is enough to give it, like, it does one of two things. It either can take you out of the moment very briefly, or it can do that thing where, and I think we talked about this on the show before, where it's like clearly trying to be an American high school, but it's sort of like a based on TV idea of what an American high school is.
It is.
So it's like weirdly, it's weirdly like, it is the thing you're familiar with, but it's not, and it's just sort of subtly different, and it is just sort of awkward. But it's not bad. It doesn't ruin the game or anything. It just is like, don't be surprised if occasionally a high schooler starts talking about advanced AP college-level concepts, even though she's bored in class, that sort of thing. Like, it doesn't... If you can just sort of let yourself go and go with the flow, it's fine.
As someone entering his last year of high school, Retzkarn, I think that you should play it. It might be a useful instructional, educational sort of experience for you.
Ha, freaking ha. Josh, sum it up in one sentence.
Well, in the end, I think it's... like, none of the flaws of Life is Strange detract to such a degree that they couldn't fix them in the next episode, so I'm pretty excited to see what happens with the subsequent releases.
Yeah, me too.
It's definitely a really cool game, and if you like Telltale games, you should check it out. Or Twin Peaks and high school dramas, which don't generally go together, but...
In conclusion, 2015 already has better games than 2014.
Kind of sad, but that's true.